There on the lonely plains of Dura, a critical battle was unfolding. Two major forces were speeding along, destined to collide in this province of Babylon. There would be a clash of cultures, of religions, of wills. This battle would determine who in Dura was durable. It is interesting to note the meaning of the word Dura. It means circle or dwelling. It comes from a root word which means to reside. Then Dura may represent the believer's place of residence. Like Dura, the world is a testing ground for the believer's faith. And every day some false idol is erected in this Dura, designed to clash with your beliefs, with your convictions, with your commitment to Christ. Those desiring to remain loyal to Christ must follow the example of our three heroes, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. This story has always been one of my favorites since I was a little child. I think it's every child's favorite story. I remember the story of a little boy that came home from Sunday school one day, and he told his mother, he says, "We learned the story of shake the bed, make the bed, and in the bed we go." Well, I think some of our critics, the Bible critics, have looked at this story and wanted to make fun of it as well. They've claimed that it's not real, it's not true. Well, it is. This historical account gives accurate details, names of people, locations which are real. It is an accurate accounting of an actual event. It is a story which highlights the heroic faith of three devoted servants and their sovereign God who reigns over all. And our God delights to show His sovereign power today. He is simply waiting to see faith-filled servants that are standing tall in the face of trials. The story moves along quickly. There are three basic components to it. We've got the convictions that they have that are challenged in verses 1 through 12. The convictions are challenged. Nebuchadnezzar's image was made, and it's an impressive image. It was made of gold. It's made, we believe, of an enlarged statue of himself. Perhaps he was inspired by the events from the previous chapter, the dream that he had. And so it was probably a statue of himself. This was not uncommon for kings of all eras to erect statues to remember their greatness and their glory. They wanted people to recognize who they were. It might have been that this was about 20 years later. We don't know the exact time. It may have been after he had completed his military campaigns and had conquered all of the surrounding nations, and he was now making an image in dedication to his gods. And so he comes back as the reigning monarch of a great empire, and he lifts a large statue that is made completely of gold, 90 feet high, 9 feet wide. In the late 1800s, a famous archaeologist, Julius Opert, discovered a few miles south of Babylon a brick base square that was about 20 feet high and about 45 feet square. And he claims that this was probably the base of this statue that Nebuchadnezzar raised in the events that are described in chapter 3. But you notice he made the image completely of gold. Some believe that this would be a statement of rebellion against God. A statement that says, though he knew that the image that he saw was to be replaced with the gold of, replaced with silver in the arms and chest, and later on with bronze and so on, he was saying, no, my kingdom is the greatest and it will last forever. So it may have been his attempt in his creation of this image to say, your God doesn't reign, I reign. An impressive image. Imagine the value of that image. Tons of gold would be in the billions and billions of dollars today. An impressive image indeed. Not only was there an impressive image in verses 2 and following, we see that there was an impressive event. A very impressive event. This event included five major components. First of all, we see dignitaries lined up. It's a long line of dignitaries that are listed here that are summoned to this ceremony, and it must have been very impressive. Daniel twice repeats this long list of eight different levels of dignitaries in this great empire. It was the greatest and most important officials that were called to the ceremony. They probably marched parade style to their assigned territory before this statue and stood at attention in all of their brilliant, shining uniforms. And the masses of people came. They were all anticipating a great event here. And they called it a dedication. That's the second major component. We see that there were dignitaries, important people. Anyone who was important was there, and the masses, of course. And he called this a dedication in verse 2 and 3. Come to the dedication of the image. Seemed to be a harmless occasion. This king had no doubt been building many other massive buildings. We know that he was a great architect, and he's well known today still for the Hanging Gardens, the famous one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. And so he was a great man of construction, and so they had been used to this king building things, no doubt other dedications. But now he has the dedication of the statue of himself. This will be the greatest event. They had been to other bureaucratic events. This would be the greatest of all. And so we have an impressive image with dignitaries lining up and a great dedication. Thirdly, we see that there was a lot of music involved. There was music involved. Maybe it was a grand concert that was the prelude to it all. Maybe it was the powerful climax to this great event. Perhaps he employed music for a hypnotizing effect. Music has often been used by various groups as a controlling influence. But here, its importance and connection with devilish worship is highlighted no less than four times in the text when he repeats all the list of instruments and talks about it. Music certainly has a great impact on groups and crowds. It is a powerful medium that can be used positively or negatively. In this case, it was apparently a mixed conglomeration of all kinds of music, it says. It was designed to whip the masses into an emotional frenzy. Errant religions often use music as a tool like that for entertainment or hypnosis. And so we see that there's dignitaries and dedication and music. And fourth, I want you to notice that there is deception here. Deception. In verse 4, the ceremony had been called a dedication, but now a shift is taken here. And he tells them that this dedication is going to include some worship. You're going to bow down when you hear the music, and you're going to worship the image. The shocking command for enforced state religion. There's no indication that the government officials had received prior warning to this ceremony that they would include state worship. They had been given the impression that it was a dedication ceremony, a political and a patriotic rally, perhaps. But whenever everyone arrived, they changed their tune. You will bow down. This kind of deception is the devil's design in perverting true worship today. In such a case, religion becomes a tool of the state to hold people in subjection and thereby wield more power. It's interesting to see in Iran and Iraq and other Muslim countries today, they're still mixing politics with deception and religion to their advantage. It's nothing new. In 1936, Herr Baldur von Schirach, who was in charge of the entire youth program for Germany, said in an address to the German youth, he said, "One cannot be a good German and at the same time deny God. But an avowal of faith in the eternal Germany is at the same time an avowal of faith in the eternal God. If we act as true Germans," he said, "we act according to the laws of God. Whoever serves Adolf Hitler, the Führer, serves Germany, and whoever serves Germany serves God." With their twisted rationalization, they attempted to deceive the masses. And there's a lot of that kind of deceptive, twisted logic being preached today as well. May God help us to discern the difference. And so we find that they employed deception here. Fifthly, I want you to see that they also employed coercion. Coercion, verses 6 and 7, they find out now that if you don't bow, you will burn. They used superstition and fear. The death penalty was prescribed for any dissenters. False religions, which gained more power, used this tool of threatening to keep their people in subjection. In this case, the ultimate threat was given. If you don't bow, you will die a very painful death. And so we find that we have an impressive image and a very impressive event at this time. There are tons of organizations today that are trying to present impressive events and to present impressive images as well, from buildings to great events. We've got a lot of them going on right now. The NBA National Championship, National Hockey League Stanley Cup Playoff, the Major League Baseball World Series, the NFL Super Bowl. And on we could go with that. Of course, there's the Olympics and the World Cup Championship and the presidential inauguration. All of these events, great events, seem to be designed to produce mass human admiration of a person or people. Man in his fallen nature loves to usurp the place of God in attracting worship. We find that there is not only an impressive image and an impressive event, there is also an impressive stand by our three heroes. The vast majority of people living in that empire in Nebuchadnezzar's day, religion to them was perhaps a matter of preference and convenience, but to these three heroes, it was a matter of primary importance and conviction. To bow down was to break their pledge and promise to the God who told them, "Do not make any false images, nor do not bow down to them as well." Obedience to the God of heaven superseded obedience to an earthly king. And so they stood in defiance to the command of the king and in obedience to the command of God. What discernment and dedication these three heroes demonstrated. They quickly recognized the nature of the command. It was a command to idolatry. Of course, they could have rationalized, "Well, everybody's doing it," or, "We could probably just bow down. We don't even have to close our eyes. We don't really have to worship. After all, worship is a matter of the heart, isn't it?" They could have rationalized a lot of things, but they didn't. While everyone else bowed, they stood tall and firm. Years ago, a poem was written by Percy Shelley. He said this, "I met a traveler from an antique land who said, 2 vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read, which yet survive, stamped on those lifeless things, the hand that mocked them and the heart that fed. And on the pedestal these words appear, 'My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair.'" Shelley concludes his poem by saying this, "Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away." Ozymandias was a man a lot like Nebuchadnezzar, who's a lot like a lot of people today, who are trying to build impressive images or accomplish impressive feats crying out to the world's masses for attention and applause. They spend their lives to build a giant, colossal wreck, which they will leave behind in the fallen sands of time. Nebuchadnezzar, at this point in his life, was like the fool who was willing to gain the whole world and lose his own soul. Our three heroes, on the contrary, of course, were about to lose their world, but their soul was firmly in the hand of God, a sovereign God. I wonder how many of us today are trying to build impressive images and create impressive events. Many people and pastors sometimes are trying to build their churches in that way. Let us not sell our soul for the applause of men to build large crowds. Let us be faithful to God. Let us not bow to the gods of this world. The text moves on, and in verses 13 through 18, the convictions of our three heroes rises to a higher level. We find them standing up with courageous commitment. Courageous commitment in the face, first of all, of demonic fury. Demonic fury. Notice in our text in verse 13, the combination of words rage and fury. Nebuchadnezzar, it emphasizes the king's intense anger here. He was having a temper tantrum, and it's possible that part of his anger was caused by the belief or the realization that these men, he had put them up in higher positions, and now this is the way they treat him? He might expect something from the masses, but not from those that he had elevated to a higher position. And so he's angry with them. Surely a mistake had been made. Perhaps they didn't understand. Nebuchadnezzar, no doubt, had been aware of chapter 2, the events of chapter 2, and he was kind of impressed with Daniel's God. And he says, okay, your God's okay, but when I do something for my God, you ought to be respectful for my God. The ecumenical crowd never understands the believer's refusal to cooperate. He gives them a second chance in verse 15. He makes a statement that is really a challenge to the God of heaven. At the end of that verse, in verse 15, he asks, "And who is that God that shall deliver you out of my hands?" There isn't any God that can deliver you out of the death penalty that I will put upon you if you don't bow. All our three heroes stand up in the face of that raging fury, but they also stand up in the face of death itself. And not any kind of death, but death by fire. We see here in verses 16 through 18 the unflinching courage of our three heroes. Their answer was brief, to the point, and unmistakable. Meshach and Abednego refused to bow. There are three critical matters that these men want to declare, want to make very clear in their response. First of all, they want the king to know that they are not afraid. They want the king to know that they have no fear. And so they emphasize the fearlessness by saying in verse 16 and 17, "Well, king, we're not careful to answer thee in this matter. If it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us." Our God is able. And when you have a God like that, you don't need to be afraid. And they weren't afraid. Our God is able is a great statement. The omnipotent God that we serve flung the stars in space. The one who responded to Joshua's request and halted the mighty mass of burning fuel 10 billion times the size of Nebuchadnezzar's puny little fire. To even question his ability is a dangerous absurdity. He himself asked a foolish question to Jeremiah the prophet just a few, perhaps at the same time. Jeremiah chapter 32, verse 27. Behold, I am the Lord God of all flesh. Is there anything too hard for me? The answer is absolutely not. Our God is able. When threatened by the little fire of this puny king, it may be that the three men remembered the cascade of fire and brimstone from heaven which destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. Or perhaps they thought of the fire which enveloped the mountain, Mount Sinai, when God came and gave the Ten Commandments. Possibly they remembered the fire of God which slew Nadab and Abihu, or the rebellious crowd who followed Korah, Dathan, and Abiram in Numbers 16. Or perhaps they thought about the fire of God which fell at Elijah's command on Mount Carmel, or when he called out when the soldiers of King Ahaziah threatened to take his life. Truly, the master of fire was God, not Nebuchadnezzar. He knew how to create fire, and he knew how to put it out. No fire of the king was a problem to such a great God. And this puny fire, though heated seven times hotter, was still a pitiful comparison to the vast, eternal flames of hell. No, they were not afraid of the king's fire. They had a great God. They wanted the king to know that they weren't afraid. They also wanted the king to know something else. Not only were they fearless, they also had faith. They had faith. In verse 17, there's an amazing statement made. And it says, if it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of thine hand, O king. He will deliver us. They were expressing absolute faith in their God. They didn't know how, but they were trusting him. What faith, what boldness. No wonder their feat is recorded for us in the great hall of faith in Hebrews 11, where it tells us that their faith quenched the violence of fire. They wanted the king to know that they were fearless, they had no fear, and they also had faith, but he also wanted them to know that they were going to be faithful. They were fearless, they weren't afraid to die. They had faith in God's ability and his willingness to deliver them, but even if he didn't, they were going to be faithful. They state it very clearly there in verse 18, but if God chooses not to deliver us, O king, be it known unto thee, O king, that we will not serve thy gods nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up. This declaration has to be one of the most heroic documents in the annals of history. It is the substance of holy faith. Here we see the example of allegiance which has inspired the bravery of millions of martyrs. Millions of martyrs for Christ through the centuries. In this declaration, the heartbeat of true Christian disciples is seen in its purest form. Whenever your allegiance to Christ is challenged, may you stand up and respond with this brand of holy boldness. The Christian cannot serve any other God. If called upon to seal your consecration to Christ with your life, may God give you the boldness, and may you look to our three heroes and to Christ himself, who demonstrated that kind of boldness when he went to the cross. Our three heroes certainly demonstrated courageous commitment. Courageous commitment. We conclude the story by going to verses 19 through 30, where we see Christ in the crisis. Christ in the crisis, you can tell by that statement what my interpretation of the Nebuchadnezzar statement is. But at this point in the narrative, our hearts turn to the hope of deliverance for these boys. We know that they're going to be delivered. We know the story well. We know that God is with them, but place yourself in the shoes of these three heroes for a few moments, if you could, please. Do they see Christ in the crisis at this time? No, they don't. He's invisible to them. All they see at this moment is the king's fury and the terrifying death chamber which is being heated up for their death. Now, the king's last temper tantrum was just kind of a passing thunderhead. Now, he breaks out in a massive killer tornado. The issue goes beyond his gods. These three cocky men have dared to defy his commands. No one in the world could defy him. You will die. They would pay. And he emphasizes with seven times hotter the magnitude of his anger. And he commands that fire to be heated up seven times hotter. Of course, the king is acting foolishly. He's kind of acting like a man who's got stung by a bee and catches that bee and he stomps on it. All he needs to do is step on the bee, but he stomps on it and he grinds it into the cement. He wants to he's acting furiously. Of course, God uses this evil design of a raging pagan to magnify his glory and power in a greater deliverance for his loyal servants. Nebuchadnezzar's temper tantrum, however, is the rage that we can find in the devil-inspired reaction to God's heroes and their faithfulness. Satan can't stand it when Christians stand faithfully. He can't stand to see you following him with loyalty. But I respond to that, let hell's fury break loose in an angry tirade against the saints. God's loyal people will still follow him. The soldiers are slain, of course. Mightiest soldiers in the army. The text is interesting that he identifies them. These weren't wimps that died. They were the biggest and strongest men to carry these men to their death. And the fire was so hot that it slew them. This testifies to the intense heat and the total impossibility that a natural explanation can be given for these heroes to escape. Now the furnace. Take a look at this furnace. W.A. Criswell described it in this way. He says it was perhaps some type of kiln. It had an opening at the top through which the disobedient were to be dropped and an opening at the bottom for refueling and through which the flames could be observed. I kind of like this second picture. I don't really know exactly what it looked like, but this one shows a little bit more where the king, as it tells us, rose up from his seat where he could see into that large opening where those three heroes fell down into the furnace. So I kind of suspect this is a little bit more what it looks like, but I anticipate it was probably something very large, and there's quite a fall for those guys. It was a miracle that they were not hurt. And the text tells us in verse 23, it says, and these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell down bound into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Having been bound, they could not land on their feet. When they were dropped into the large kiln, they fell down into the raging fiery furnace. Now, I know you know the rest of the story, but just pretend for a moment that you don't. And I want you to think with me for a moment. I want you to ask a question. Where was God at this time? Where is God while this moment of horror unfolds? Has he abandoned them? Why doesn't he do something? He seems to be standing idly by. It appears as though our three heroes will be burnt to ashes very quickly, and that God is allowing this tragedy to happen. Now, surely he is there, but you can't see him. His invisible presence seems to be signifying a lack of concern. Let me make this statement before we go to the end of this story. God does not choose to rescue all of his servants, his faithful servants, from death. He does allow some of them to go through and to die a martyr's death. Is he still with them? Absolutely. He is with them all the way, giving them divine strength for their final hours. Some of you have had some fiery furnace in your life, difficult circumstances, and you have wondered, where is God in this? All your theology is right. You know it says, I will never leave thee nor forsake thee. You know he's with you, but you can't see him in the trial. But you must remember he is there. He's invisible, but he's there. But oh, now we see him identified in the next verse. Verse 25, I believe, is a Christophany. Nebuchadnezzar states that the fourth person walking around in the fire looks like a son of the gods, or like the son of God. Big theological debate amongst the scholars what this is. Later on, Nebuchadnezzar calls him the angel of the Lord. The wording here is very similar to chapter 7 and verse 13, where it talks about the Son of Man identifying Christ very clearly. I wouldn't state it, you know, without question, dogmatically, but I think it's Christ. I think Christ came down there and protected them. Pre-incarnate manifestation of the Lord Jesus Christ. And his presence makes them, our three heroes, indestructible. Verses 26 and 27, the ropes which had bound these men apparently burned off, and now they're able to get up and walk around freely in the fire. And the flames had no effect on them whatsoever. They weren't even a little too warm. They were content to walk around in the midst of the fire. They weren't even looking for a way to escape. Why escape from the presence of Christ? Because the Lord was with them. Wherever Christ is, folks, his people are protected and content. With the presence of Christ, we can go through any fiery trial. If Christ were to take us into the flames of hell itself, that would be better than heaven without him. For Christ is the glory of heaven, and any place without Christ becomes like hell. The greatest tragedy of hell is not the torture of fire and brimstone. It is the eternal separation from Christ. With Christ, these men were fireproof. And isn't it wonderful how God, when he does a miracle, he doesn't do it halfway? I mean, he did it the whole way through. 100% pure. It wasn't a partial miracle. He doesn't give a 75% healing, and he didn't just protect them 75%. The details of this verse are picky and minute, verse 27. It's God's purpose to show that this deliverance out of the fire wasn't by accident or by luck. They didn't just have a close call or escape by the hair of their chinny-chin-chin. Nor was there an hair of their head singed, the text says. Surely the flames that slew Nebuchadnezzar's mighty men would have at least singed the hair of the three heroes if God hadn't protected them. Not even the smell of fire could be detected on their clothes. This must have been quite a scene to behold when the three men walked out of the burning kiln. The government officials swarmed around them, touching them gingerly to see if they were hot or even a little bit warm. They didn't want to burn their hands on them, or to see if they were real, peering closely at their heads and faces to see if there was singed hair, sticking their noses into their clothing to sniff for smoke. Ah, what an amazing God they serve. He was incomparable. Incomparable, that was the only conclusion that they could come up with. There is no God like the God of these three men. He was greater than the king or the king's gods. They had never seen anything like this before. Their God had rendered King Nebuchadnezzar helpless, and he had done it with relative ease. This was far superior to anything they'd ever seen, and prompted the king to make a decree in honor of their God with a statement recognizing his superiority. We might say it something like this today: our God reigns. I'd like to conclude this morning with some application. This afternoon, I'm used to preaching in the morning. There's a lot of applications we could make in this from this story. I'd just like to conclude with three. The first one is this. I'd encourage all of us this afternoon to examine our personal convictions. Examine your convictions. We see these men that had great convictions. By the way, when you do start to develop convictions, you can count on them being challenged. You can count on them causing people to get angry at you. When you have those convictions and you stand up and you follow them, there's going to be somebody that's going to get raging mad at you. They may even try to kill you. That's what happened to these three men. They weren't looking for a fight. They weren't looking to be killed. They simply had some convictions. Their convictions meant something to them, and they said, "I will not bow." We need great discernment today as well in these establishing these convictions. Was it a dedication service or was it a worship service? There's a lot of mixing in our worship today and in our world. The devil is skillful in trying to get us to bow in the convenience. There's even a lot of hero worship today. Be careful not to rationalize. Examine your convictions. And then secondly, I'd encourage you to stand with courage. Once you have developed those convictions, I challenge you to stand up with conviction and with courage like the three men that we just saw. We live in a soft age, in an age of easy believism and shallow convictions, a day when you see relatively few Christians taking a stand. The pressure will always be there to compromise, to take the easy path, to just get along with everybody. The temptations to bow will always be strong. You can count on this. Your convictions will be challenged. The question is, will you take a stand for God? I just encourage you to consider this statement. Maybe you want to write it down. I think these three heroes were making a statement with their actions and their words that would say something like this: death is better than apostasy. Death is better than defection. Will you stand with courage? Will you stand with courage? Lastly, I'd like to encourage you to consider this, challenge you to live and die with confidence. We're all going to die anyway. Some may die earlier. We're living in an age when we're seeing the political and the religious scene on our nation and our world changing. Many of us suspect that it won't be long before those of us in fundamental circles will be called upon to suffer for our convictions. There may be some in this room who will be called upon to seal their convictions and their faith with their lives, with their blood. Couldn't help but thinking that just last Friday as I was interviewing a couple serving on the board with Baptist Missions. It was a young couple who was coming and applying with our mission. They're going to one of the restricted access nations. Many of those restricted access nations are very dangerous to serve in today. I thought to myself as I was interviewing this couple and listening to them give a defense of the things that they believed, I thought about all the young men sometimes we question at ordination councils. We want to know what they believe. I often ask the question, are you a Baptist? Yeah, I'm a Baptist. Are you a Baptist by conviction or by convenience? What do you believe that makes you a Baptist? How do you know you're a Baptist? What would you stand for? What would you die for? Oh, it's easy in those early days, maybe not so easy when you study up, but to give an answer at an ordination council. I couldn't help it as I was looking at this couple. Maybe the next few years, when they're out there witnessing and they're in trouble, I thought to myself, be looking at a future martyr or martyrs. Years ago, a man by the name of John Rogers, who lived from 1500 to 1555. Some of you may know about this man. He was inspired by William Tyndale, became good friends with him, and tried to carry on the torch after Tyndale's death. He is credited with printing the first complete English Bible that was translated completely from the Greek and Hebrew. He preached in London about the time that Bloody Mary came to power. And it didn't take him long before they arrested him and threw him in one of the famous prisons there in London. They mistreated him and tortured him. And finally, one Monday morning, I thought that's a great day for a burning. Monday morning, it's where preachers don't like. February 4th in 1555, he was awakened early and told to prepare himself for the fire. He asked one request that he might have the opportunity to talk to his wife briefly for a moment. They denied that request. He was questioned once again by an attending officer. The sheriff came in and asked him if he would recant, if he would revoke his, what he called, abominable doctrine. John Rogers restated with this great statement. He said, "That which I have preached, I will seal with my blood." The man swore at him. They marched him off to be burned at the stake. On the way to the place of burning, he encountered his wife. The word had gotten out, and she brought the 10 children that they had. The youngest was a baby that they said was still nursing. And that family, wife and children, was brought out, and he was able to see them as he went along the way. They brought him to the place of burning, and they brought a pardon, and they said, "We will give this pardon to you right now if you will reject your teachings and turn away." And he refused. He went to the stake. God did not deliver him. He went to the stake, and as Fox's Book of Martyrs says, washed his hands in the fire, sealing what he had preached with his blood. So I plead with you today, may God help all of us to live and die, if necessary, with confidence. The confidence of a John Rogers, a confidence of Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego, a confidence of Christ's presence and enabling power, a confidence that He has given us that promise, "I will never leave thee nor forsake thee." I wonder, as I have spoken this morning, how many of us in this crowd, looking back, and we have to ask the question, the convictions that I have, are they God's convictions? Maybe you started out well. I look back in my earlier years and I was so bold and willing to charge in where angels feared to tread. I tell you what, there's a lot of things that the devil brings up to challenge us every day. His goal is to get us to compromise when we take a stand for Christ. Have you compromised at all, Pastor? Mrs. Pastor? Layman? What kind of convictions do you have today? Are you willing to stand up and say, "I will follow the Lord Jesus Christ. I will remain pure. I will not bow down to the gods of this world. I will not let the Satan's attempts to pull me away and to compromise, to fraternize with the world, with the enemy." Some of you may be going through some difficult fires today. My 28 years in Berea, we've had some fires. Every pastor knows what it's like to be a fireman. You're always trying to put them out, aren't you? Sometimes those fires burn pretty hot, and in trying to put them out, you get burned a little bit. You get weary. You want to sometimes say, let somebody else deal with that. You wonder if God is really watching you and your heroic efforts to put that fire out. Or maybe you're in the middle of the fire and getting burned good. You wonder what God's doing. Perhaps it was this story, these thoughts, that inspired the words to that hymn. Fear not, I am with thee, oh, be not dismayed, for I am thy God, I will still give thee aid. I'll strengthen thee, help thee, and cause thee to stand, upheld by my righteous, omnipotent hand. When through fiery trials thy pathway shall lie, my grace, all sufficient, shall be thy supply. The flame shall not hurt thee. I only design thy dross to consume and thy gold to refine. May God help us to never forget our God is reigning. He is a God worth standing up for. Let's bow together and pray. Father, thank you for our three heroes, for the example that they were in this strategic point in history. When their world was coming apart, they remained faithful and showed great commitment to their convictions. And oh God, would you help us to not only be inspired by that and encouraged by that, but may we be faithful to thee as well. And when we stand before thee at the judgment seat of Christ, we might hear those coveted words, well done, thou good and faithful servant. Bless, I pray, in Jesus' name. Amen.